Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Nature Now for Earth Week in April. This is Mary Robson, thinking about the spring which is with us from earth to sky. We'll be talking about Earth with Annika Wallendale. But first, the mystery sound. And some observations. More hummingbird news. I am so interested in hummingbirds that those of you who have heard me for a while are probably saying, what? More hummingbird news? But here's a couple things that I found lately, partly because I saw the courting flight of an anise hummingbird, which went straight up, moving so fast its wings were nearly invisible, to about 50 feet. And then it drops straight down as if pulled back to earth. But it is facing the sun always. And I thought about, why do they do that? Because the sun lights up the bright red feathers and they really want to impress the female. In the final stage, the male swoops down over the female. When I saw this, I did not see a female. Maybe he was just showing off, but it takes a lot of energy, so seems to me unlikely to be wasted. And there is new research on how hummingbirds take in liquid. People for years have said it has something to do with capillary action, but here's what happens. The hummingbird tongue opens very quickly in the liquid and then folds and makes what is called a micropump, or what could be a micropump, maybe 15 times a second, if you can believe it. And watching, we can note they stay only briefly at the feeder, and thanks to the shape of their tongue, it's enough to get what they want.
Here's a report from the Orca Network. A burst of mammal eaters in the Greater Inland Basin this week brought together orcas from great distances, including the exciting discovery of a pod of unknowns who had never before been documented in the Salish Sea. It is interesting to map out the travels of the many matrilines and individuals, as well as who they are associating with, through the various reports and photos submitted and gathered. Encounter reports from April 11th in Howe Sound, Georgia Strait, and further north in Discovery Passage exemplify the beauty in their social activities and illustrate their skills and cooperation while traveling and hunting together, leaving humans awed and oftentimes transformed. A rare sight was caught on tape by a Vancouver man boating near Boyer Island, north of Horseshoe Bay. While out on a joyride Tuesday afternoon, Elliot Funt says he saw a pod of at least six orca whales swimming between boats and chasing an adult sea lion. Thanks to the Orca Network for this.
Our interview today is with Annika Wallendale. She is a geologist, a science writer. She created the terrific field guide to local common beach stones, and she is an enthusiast for Earth. Nature Now is known for what we study, local flora, local fauna, and earth. We are going to be talking about meteorites. That has something to do with Port Townsend? I'm surprised.
Well, it actually does. In 1895, on June 15th, there was a meteorite that fell in Chimicum.
I am sure that this is news to most of our listeners, so let's go on and say more about it.
It was observed by several residents, and it shook the earth up to 3 miles away.
Wow. So it was heavy and big, obviously big enough to shake the earth. And how do we know that this happened?
There was a county surveying party out in Chimicum Valley. They observed where it went. It buried itself in the peat and mud, so It wasn't recovered. But the newspaper reports from back then state that it boiled the waters for 12 hours afterwards.
That's impressive. That is a lot of heat that thing carried in from out of town. Right. So you researched this event of the meteor, which must have been very big if it boiled water for 12 hours. How big was it?
The newspaper report said they estimated it was about 5,000 pounds.
In meteorite world, how big would that be? Do you have any idea?
That's pretty large. I mean, a lot of meteorites that are found are fragments, like the size of a softball or a quarter, but there are definitely larger ones that have been recovered.
Wow. So what brought you to know about this because it's not something that is just making the headlines now. Meteorite falls in Chimicum Valley.
Well, when I moved to the area in 2006, I was living in Port Hadlock, and one night I thought I felt an earthquake. So I got up and tried to check out the UW's website for seismology to see if they had recorded anything. And when I Googled Chimicum meteorite, what came up was the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network's historic earthquake catalog. And that's where I found it. It's event number 285. And they logged it in the seismic network because it did shake crockery and make dishes break in people's houses up to 3 miles from the impact.
The impact might have felt like an earthquake to people who didn't realize that this is actually a meteor.
Yeah.
So when did this appear in the paper? What did the surveying crew talk to a reporter? How did that work?
Yeah. The Port Townsend Morning Leader on June 16th published an account because it happened the day before on June 15th. So I'd like to read you what ran in the newspaper.
Oh, I would love to listen.
From the Morning Leader, June 16th, 1895. Last night at 8 o'clock in Chimicum, a small farming center 4 miles from here experienced a terrific explosion and jar, the result of the falling of a 5,000-pound meteor, which burst with a loud noise at the height of 100 yards, and after causing a small-sized cyclone of several minutes' duration, buried itself deep in the muddy waters of a neighboring lagoon. The meteor struck the bottom with force enough to break crockery and farmhouses 3 miles away, creating terror among residents who believed that the end of the world had come. 10 hours after the occurrence, the waters of the lagoon were still bubbling and seething and were found to be hot enough to readily cook an egg. A systematic dragging of the lagoon failed to bring up any trace of the celestial messenger, which is believed to have buried itself in the earth.
What was the response? Do you know anything about the local response besides terror? I should think it would be terrifying. The surveying crew reported?
Yeah, so William Bishop of Chimicum was interviewed for the story. So his quote was, "It seemed to be making straight for us," said Mr. Bishop. "And although it happened so quickly, giving us no warning that we did not see it, yet it seemed like a cannonball shooting through the air and coming directly toward us. There were 9 of us all together who heard it, including County Surveyor Godfrey."
That is fascinating. So if anyone ever asks you, where did a meteorite fall in the Port Townsend area? It's the Chimicum Valley, and you heard it on Nature Now, thanks to Annika. So let's talk a little bit about meteorites in general, because I know you have a special interest in them. Are they the same as a falling star? Have I got my astronomy all mixed up here?
A falling star can be any small particle that burns up before it lands on the ground. So those would be like meteor showers that you see in the summer.
Like the August 11th showers. Yes.
Yeah.
So we watch the sky and look. Yeah.
Yeah. And about 60 tons of dust falls from space onto Earth every day. So the friction from small dust and fragments creates the light or streaks across.
What you see as a falling, quote, star, which it isn't. But 60 tons of meteorite dust? How did somebody figure out that figure? Nobody's counting.
Well, they've looked at areas, say, like Antarctica, and seen how much dust falls there, and then they've made estimates.
Okay. You have been interested in meteorites for a long time, and you said you had written about the Santa Fe impact crater, which I don't know a thing about, and this meteorite that fell on Port Townsend left no impact crater because it was underwater. So you had some time of thinking and looking at a very large old crater in Santa Fe. Somehow I think of these things as being in the Southwest, but I think it's probably because they're more obvious when they've left craters.
That's correct. You're typically more likely to see a crater or what's left of a crater in an area where there's not a lot of vegetation.
Right. Or parking lots or large buildings. Right. Yeah. Somebody who was just wandering around discovered this Santa Fe crater?
Well, it's an interesting story. It was actually discovered by a citizen scientist, a resident of Santa Fe. He was a geologist, and when he retired, he started mapping his backyard and the area around where he lived. And his name is Tim McElvain. And he found field evidence indicating that there had been a meteor impact there a very long time ago in the older rocks. And he worked to collect the evidence and brought it to conferences and samples to scientists. And it took several years, but there was enough lines of evidence in the rocks found that it's now a confirmed impact site.
Right. And the meteor itself either shattered or has over time vanished? I mean, you've got a place where something big landed, but nothing big to look at.
Yeah, so you take a look at a relatively small meteorite, which like the one in Chimicum was, and it buries itself in the ground, or maybe it'll leave a small dent a couple feet around it. But if you get a really large impact, it actually will vaporize the rock that it hits in, and it actually completely sacrifices itself into molten rock vapor. And then it fractures the rock around it and sends shockwaves through it. Mm-hmm. And those shockwaves leave field evidence that's known as shatter cones. And so that's one of the field indicators.
This would have happened long, long, long before human habitation of the area, yes? I mean, I was trying to figure out how do people respond if a meteorite actually lands near them. And it does happen. It's happened in Russia and recently and other places, right?
There's been several meteorite falls that have been observed and finds, but most of the really large impacts happened early on in our solar system. Mm-hmm. So the heavy impact cratering period ended about 4 billion years ago.
That's wild.
So you can look at the moon, and geologists have done that. And if you have a younger crater on top of an older crater, and you returned a sample from the moon and you've been able to date it, that's part of how they've reconstructed the cratering history, because there really aren't plate tectonics moving around on the moon to erase rocks like
of
we have
the on Earth. Few people on Earth who have landed on the moon, were there any geologists?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Unfortunately, I can't remember their names.
That's all right. They would know what they were looking for if they were going to try to bring home samples to be studied.
Yeah, and there's planetary geologists that work for the missions also that identify which areas should be collected from.
Wow. I just found myself reading about a Chinese farmer who had a rather large meteorite fall in his field, and he's trying to get it back from the Chinese government because they believe that anything, I guess, that lands anywhere belongs to them. And he says no, because it came from outer space. If one landed in my backyard and I wanted to keep it, could I keep it? This is America. Could I keep a meteor?
If it lands on your property, you are considered the owner.
In this country?
In the United States. But this varies country to country. For example, in Switzerland, all finds, like meteorite finds, are owned by the state, but the finder is paid compensation.
Aha.
In the U.S., if somebody finds a meteorite on federal property, like a national park, then it belongs to the United States government.
That makes a lot of sense. There are a couple things I just wanted to wind up with. I know you're interested in meteorites. What is, as far as we can tell, the scientific value of studying meteors?
One of the important things about meteorites is there's a type of meteorite called a chondrite, and it's composed of chondrules. And these are tiny glassy spheres that were formed very early on in the birth of the solar system and the universe. And these are preserved in meteorites, but not on Earth, since we've had plate tectonics. So if you want a window into the past, pre-Earth and pre-Moon and pre-Mars, then you look to chondrites.
Okay. It seems to me that there is a sort of otherworldliness, literally, about meteorites, but there's also a sense of it came from outer space, and that gives it a kind of aura that a lot of things that just turn up don't have. So do you want to go on with that a little?
Well, just to prove that you really can buy everything local in Port Townsend, you can even shop for meteorites at meteoritemarket.com, which has been operated since 1995 by Eric and Jane Ann Twelker of Port Townsend.
They are here. So there is a meteorites.com.
Meteoritemarket.com.
Wow.
So you can even buy your meteorites locally in Port Townsend.
Well, we've talked a little bit about a meteor that fell on us and meteors in general, but it might be interesting to know a little bit more about the nature of these impact craters. Can we figure that we've seen all the impact craters we're going to get on Earth, or?
People are still discovering them every year, these ancient impact craters, and some of them are not very ancient at all.
That's the scary part. Right?
Yeah, there's a crater called the Haviland Crater. It's also known as the Brenham Crater, and that's in Kansas, and it's only about 50 feet in diameter, and it's believed to be less than 1,000 years old.
So people who were living there would have definitely seen it. And I don't know if there's a mythic description of it or anything like that, but that's not very long ago.
No, and they're still recovering meteorite material from there and selling it on eBay and on the internet. And so far, they've recovered 7 tons of meteorite material. And it's a type of meteorite called a palisite.
What exactly is a palisite?
Let me back up. There's three main kinds of meteorites. There's stony meteorites, iron meteorites, and stony iron meteorites. And a palisite is a type of the third kind, the stony iron, and it has large crystals of olivine in a matrix of iron and nickel. And it's a beautiful meteorite. If you slice it thinly, olivine is the mineral that the gemstone's called peridot. It just is a very beautiful, and because it's so aesthetically pleasing, it's one of the most expensive.
These are then being found and used by jewelers still, yes?
Yeah, I would say that jewelers are very reluctant. I've seen meteorite jewelry, but typically it's rough, right?
A chunk.
Yeah,
right.
A chunk. Yeah.
Okay, so are any of these meteorites more common? Is the stony type more common than not? Or does that make any difference when you're studying them as to which is the most common?
Well, most meteorites are the stony variety, and a lot of those are chondrites, which contains the chondrules.
Right.
Even though most of the meteorites are stony meteorites, they blend right in with other rocks here on Earth. So if you don't see the meteorite fall and see where it lands, then most of the ones found are actually the irons.
Okay. What's left from whatever shattering there is then?
A rock that falls into a pile of nether rocks is harder to find. But if you have iron meteorite, it's going to probably have that fusion crust and look different from the soil or the sand that it lands in.
Have you ever personally found a piece of a meteorite?
It's on my bucket list. I have not.
Okay. So this is to Nature Now listeners. If you find a place with a meteorite chunk, get in touch with Annika. She'd like to know.
Well, it's actually a profession. There are professional meteorite hunters.
There are.
They use metal detectors in Nevada, Arizona, and other parts of the world.
For heaven's sake.
And they recover these and sell them. And that's how they make their living.
Okay. Anything you want to add before we have to halt here? It is fascinating that people actually were able to see that in 1895 and know what they were seeing.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to add is the historic Port Townsend Leader newspapers, they're available at the Jefferson County Genealogical Society.
Okay.
And that's on Highway 19 near Airport Cutoff Road. And for a $6 fee, you can go in and view all their wonderful books and archives, and you can even pull up this article.
You can find out about Port Townsend's meteor. Amazing. Thank you, Annika.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for having me.
So what was that mystery sound? It's the orange-crowned warbler. And you might think this warbler is completely misnamed because it does not have a prominent orange head. This small yellow bird doesn't show the orange spot on its head unless it's disturbed or, one writer said, excited. It is one of the few warblers native to the West. Here on the Olympic Peninsula, it stays nearly year-round, but it also breeds across Canada and all the way up into Alaska. This warbler nests on the ground, which seems somewhat risky for such a small bird. It mainly eats insects, but it shows up at my hummingbird feeder several times a day. The hummingbirds ignore it while it sips sugar water. Using the feeder has to be hard for it because it does not have the hummingbird's intricate tongue and it can't balance in midair. It sits on a little perch. Only the males of the orange-crowned warbler sing. Sometimes males in several adjacent territories will learn each other's songs. This makes a sort of community chorus of sound. So if you see what you may think is a lost canary, you have met the orange-crowned warbler. And I'm going to finally start a little with events. But because we are in Earth Week and Earth Day coming up, I thought it would be useful to talk just a little about the first Earth Day in 1970. It started as a grassroots movement, and it created public support for the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. It contributed to the passage of the Clean Air Act, the Water Quality Improvement Act, and the Endangered Species Act. All of them were passed in the early 70s, several of them under the time of Nixon. This year, locally, several events will celebrate the day, the season, and the intention of Earth Day. One place to gather will be the Science Rising Festival on April 22nd. That's this coming Saturday. It is a celebration of science. It's at the Port Angeles City Pier and Faro Marine Life Center from 10 to 4. If you want a list of speakers, check with the Olympic Climate site, which is www.ole.climate.org. There are events all day and speakers all day, and the closing speaker is Dr. Charles Brandt, who is director at Battelle, the Pacific Northwest National Lab. This is part of the April 22nd and April 29th March for Science. There will be booths and children's activities from noon to 4 p.m., and when we were talking about orcas, there was the phrase, humans are awed and oftentimes transformed about the orca observation. This also can apply to our thoughts and activities as we encounter the natural world. So check local newspapers this Earth Week for other events. That's it for Nature Now for the week of April 19th. We hope you've enjoyed this local focus on our natural world. If you have comments or ideas to share with us, send an email to naturenow@kptz.org. We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks to Charlie Fleischman for energetic engineering, to Annika for bringing us a meteor right in our very lap, and you can look for a repeat of this show on Thursday at 5 p.m., Saturday at 11:30, and it will be repeated on a podcast at kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Highway by Night, performed by J.R. Smith and the Meteorites.
The morning that the sun failed to arrive, looked outside and noticed I was barely alive. I looked at you and there was nothing left of me, nothing left to set free. Upcoming time, and the tears have been dried by the moonlight. I remember the day you lost your mind, and these days have gone blind, and inside you must have died.